Hello, and welcome to the Off the Table podcast. We are a group of global health enthusiasts from diverse backgrounds who deeply care about improving access to surgery worldwide and believe that the solutions come from the ground up. Your hosts, Amuna, Reem, Paul, and myself, Emily, will aim to create a safe environment to have comfortable and uncomfortable conversations about equitable surgery. We aim to be impactful by sending a concrete and evidence-based call to action after each conversation. We truly hope you enjoy these conversations as much as we do.
Welcome, everyone. Thank you for tuning in to episode 5 of the Off the Table podcast. My name is Paul, and my co-host today is Emily.
Welcome, everyone. On this episode, we are really excited to have Dr. Brian Madison, an orthopedic surgeon from South Sudan, firm believer of building strong surgical systems in Africa, and a global surgery champion. It's now 6 a.m. in Juba, South Sudan. So good morning, Dr. Madison.
Good morning, Emily. Nice to have you.
Thanks for coming, Dr. Madison. So first off, we were just hoping you could tell us a little bit about you, where you grew up, what made you decide to become an orthopedic surgeon, and what you really enjoy about the profession.
So Dr. Brian Madison, and I was born in Juba, South Sudan. That was back in 1985. It wasn't a country yet. It was just fresh off the war. So when I was around 4 years of age, the war intensified. Then we had to move to the northern part of the country, to Khartoum. That's basically where I grew up. That's where I studied primary school, high school, and eventually that's where I did medicine. So what made me choose orthopedics after doing medicine is that when I was in my second year med school, I had a fracture. So that actually pulled my attention towards orthopedics. I graduated in 2009, and that was in Khartoum, and then moved to South Sudan in 2010. That was just about the right time because I just finished my internship, and the country was about to vote for a referendum that's going to decide whether the country remains one or separate. So I thought it was a good opportunity for me to come back to motherland and hopefully vote, contribute towards establishment of a new country. I worked in Juba from 2010 to 2011 as a general practitioner, and then moved to an area called Eastern Equatoria, which is it's in the eastern part of the country towards the borders with Kenya. This is my homeland. This is where my father actually came from. So I thought it was good that I go there and also serve. I worked in a remote hospital, which is it's a church hospital supported by the Catholic diocese, the local Catholic diocese. That area is called Torit. So it's the Catholic Diocese of Torit. I worked there for 2.5 years. It was like probably the greatest part of my career because personally, I love being out there in the nature, and the place is really beautiful, mountains surrounding you and all that. So it was a good chance for me to be away from the loud noise of the city. And also during that time, I had a chance to plan to go for my specialty training, which was in Tanzania from 2013 to 2014, to 2017, sorry. When I finished my training in Tanzania, then I came back home, worked for a while, and then went for my fellowship. So that's briefly something about me.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. So as you said, you completed medical school in Khartoum, Sudan, then went on to do your residency in Tanzania, and in between worked all over. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the challenges that come from, you know, you wanted to pursue a career in surgical training, being from South Sudan, which is a country where there really is no formal surgical training. Could you speak a little bit to the path for doctors who want to become surgeons in South Sudan?
So training, specialty training, is a very big challenge in South Sudan. We have a lot of doctors who qualified from the north, which is Sudan. And when they moved to South Sudan, at about the time that I moved in, they did not get a chance to go for specialty training. When I came in 2010, and consequently when the country gained independence in 2011, there are no structures in place. So everything was just from scratch. So there is no surgical training. There is no pathway for surgical training back then. And unfortunately, from 2011 to now, there still is no surgical training pathway for orthopedics. Pediatrics just established a new training program that's going to kick off probably next year. It's an MMED program that's going to be affiliated with the university, but it's the first of its kind. And there is also what we call the College of Physicians and Surgeons. It's also a training initiative that was meant to help train mainly obstetrics and gynecologists as well as general surgeons, but it hasn't been performing that well. So many doctors have to travel to East African countries, namely Uganda, Kenya, Tanzania, as well as Ethiopia to do their training. There is a very big challenge with financing such a training because the government is not in place to provide funds to help train these people. They are currently offering scholarships to Ethiopia, but there is no stipends for doctors. So many people who are not financially capable end up being general practitioners forever, actually. So that's a very big challenge. And that's something that we really need to work for in the next few years.
I can't even imagine like trying to become a surgeon in those settings. And I really applaud you for these efforts. It seems like this was a tough path. I'm really interested in something you mentioned earlier, which I didn't know about you, actually, which is why we're having this conversation today, is your work back home in your the province of Eastern Equatoria. For none of our listeners, I think, know anything about South Sudan. It's such a new country, as you mentioned, and I don't think anybody has traveled there. Can you take us to that place where you work, like that hospital where you said you served for a few years, and just kind of put us in that atmosphere of Eastern Equatoria and what the healthcare system looks like and what patient care looks like on a daily basis?
Yeah, so Eastern Equatoria is actually one of the most beautiful areas in South Sudan, not because I'm coming from Eastern Equatoria, but it is really beautiful. it's always green. The weather is nice. It's not that hot. And it has a mountainous terrain. So there is the main city. Actually, it's a town. It's not as big as a city in Eastern Equatoria is Torit, which is around 80 miles or maybe 100 miles from Juba. It's not very far, but the road is really terrible. And then from Torit, the place where I walked in was approximately, say, 100 miles also from Torit, or maybe a little bit less. But again, the roads are really, really, really terrible. So the place is called Isoke. It has been a very popular destination for humanitarian workers because it's a very simple place. During the rainy season, it's completely cut off from Torit, so it's quite isolated. And because of that, during the war, it was actually a sanctuary for civilians who are actually fleeing the war, as well as the Sudan People Liberation Movement back then. So there is a very big church there, as well as a primary and secondary school. And it actually trained a lot of people from South Sudan. There is also a hospital that was established by Catholic Diocese of Torit with the help of a lot of Norwegian people aid, Norwegian church aid. And there is an NGO in Germany called Miseria. So all these partners, they came in and being a place where people flee the war towards, so they just established a hospital there, which at that time it was pretty much basic. I was the second fully qualified medical doctor to work there. Previously, it used to be run by nurses as well as clinical officers, mainly catering for basic illnesses like malaria, diarrhea, and this kind of stuff, injuries. When I came in, they just recently started doing deliveries, cesarean sections, but deliveries they used to do there before I came in. So it's a place which is surrounded by mountains. So there is a pathway, one pathway in, one pathway out, but it's completely surrounded by mountains. It's just so beautiful. Yeah.
Amazing. I actually just looked it up online and the first picture was a bunch of giraffes. Yeah. I'm sure there's much more to it.
Yeah, I know.
It sounds like paradise, and I really hope we can all enjoy that place one day, and I would really, really love to visit your beautiful country. In terms of more general question, again, for people who are not familiar, and I guess, again, none of us are very familiar with South Sudan, can you talk a little bit more about the country in general in terms of like its population, where people live? Is it more urban or rural, and what the healthcare system looks like, urban versus rural regions, and what the access, especially to surgical care, is for patients?
Yeah, so South Sudan I can't remember the exact size, but we have a population of around, in paper it's around 12 million, but I think in reality it's 10 million. Historically, there were three main regions, Upper Nile region, Bahr al-Ghazal region, and Greater Equatorial region. And there are three cities in each of these regions. So traditionally, there were three big cities. In Equatoria, it is Juba, which is currently the capital of South Sudan. And in Upper Nile, there is Malakal. While in Bahr al-Ghazal, there is Wau City. When I came to Juba in 2011, it was practically a village. There was nothing. And you'll not be surprised that the most you can see grass thatched houses and only a few houses which were built concrete. So we've come a long way from 2011 to now, or let me say from 2005, because this was the time when South Sudan was semi-independent. There was a transitional period before the referendum. So we had a period of around 6 years where the country was governing itself. So that's the time actually when development started to kick in, and we only have around 100 kilometers of paved road, which connects Juba to Nimule. It's on the South Sudanese-Ugandan borders. At the moment, there are efforts to construct more roads to connect the capital Juba to other main cities. And the population is mainly, how do I call it? It's not urban. It's only Juba, which is a city that brings on many people together, but it's mainly not an urban population. And because of that, there is no access to healthcare in general, and there is no access to surgical care in particular. And to be more particular, access to orthopedic care is a very big problem. I can confidently say that in the other two main cities of Wau and Malakal, there are no orthopedic surgeons. And the least they could get, the least they can get is a general practitioner who can do orthopedic procedures. And good enough, most of our general practitioners actually can do basic surgical procedures such as laparotomy and so forth, incision sections. But again, access to these main cities of Wau and Malakal is a very big problem. So there are people who really live in very remote areas, and the least they can get is traditional healers, access to traditional healers, and access to local doctors. They're not actually doctors, but I don't know what's the name for it, but they're not trained, but they're able to provide healthcare. So that's about it. It's just, there's a lot of work to be done in South Sudan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sounds like, a ton of work to be done, but hopefully steps are being made. So after your surgical residency, you then came to Hamilton, Canada to do an orthopedic trauma fellowship through the St. Joe's International Outreach Program, a Canadian charity which helps train doctors from Guyana, Uganda, and more recently, South Sudan. Can you tell us how you found this opportunity and kind of your experience with it?
Well, I would say that I was extremely lucky to know about the St. Joseph International Outreach Program. When I was doing my residency in Tanzania, I came to meet one of the surgeons from McMaster University at Hamilton. The hospital I did my residency in was in a special place to receive overseas volunteers, because many of them actually loved going to provide healthcare, as well as the chance to do a safari in Arusha, which is nearby, and to climb Mount Kilimanjaro, which is actually where the center I did my residency in. So I was lucky to do it in Kilimanjaro Christian Medical Center, which is right at the foot of the mountain. And we had a chance to receive Dr. Michelle Gert, who is a trauma oncologist, orthopedic oncologist in McMaster University. And she spent some time with us. And during that time, on a casual talk over breakfast, I asked if there were any opportunities, if someone wanted to do a fellowship in Canada. And her response was positive. So the discussion started in 2016. And when I finished in 2017, I started the process. It was a very lengthy process, because to get registration in Canada to practice is actually it's a long pathway. But I was determined that I wanted to do that. So it took me up until January 2020 to finally join the training program. And the advantage of that fellowship is that it was hands-on. It's something that you cannot find anywhere else, either in Europe or North America. So that was the biggest advantage of the fellowship that I did, because I had a chance to meet really great surgeons who taught me a lot. Taught me a lot, not only in trauma surgery, but also about global surgery and how to, you know, conduct research in this area. And, you know, a lot of things. And I built a lot of partnerships, a lot of friendship with these people out there. So I would say that I'm very much lucky. And I hope that many more guys from South Sudan will get a chance to go for such a training program.
You know, Brian, you mentioned twice in the past 5 minutes that you were really lucky. And it's interesting, because reflecting back on that, all I can hear in your story is that you made these opportunities happen. You actually are the one who found this residency program in Tanzania while there was zero surgical training in your country. And then you approached a surgeon about the fellowship training opportunity. And I feel like this is what happens to people who go far in life, is they actually create those opportunities. So yes, there's a little bit of luck, but I think you made it happen mostly.
Thanks. That's nice of you.
I do believe that. We want to be a little bit controversial too on this podcast, because we recognize that there's a huge divide between, especially in the field of global surgery, between like surgery in Western environments and high income countries and surgery in lower resource settings. And so I wonder, like, you know, the colonistic aspect is basically saying that the vision, that the knowledge needs to flow from Western medicine to lower resource settings, which are sometimes former colonies of those Western countries or those high-income countries. And many doctors and surgeons need to go abroad like you had to do, and sometimes really far away, to train in contexts that are very different from theirs, and learn from surgeons with trainings and pathologies that are very different from their daily realities. And you said you had a really positive experience, and I'm really glad to hear that. But I wonder, is there any other twist to that? Like, how do you feel about training in a different environment in a Western country? Just what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's actually a big challenge, because like, one of the things that we lacked since 2011 until now, basically, like, maybe we just received one maybe 1 month ago, is fluoroscopy. So we've been doing all of our surgeries without fluoroscopy, without C-arm, and we just only received it maybe about 1 month ago. So that's one of the things. When I went to Canada, the training was high-tech, let me say. I had a chance to be involved in a lot of surgeries, which are really cool, let me say. But when I came back after my fellowship, I was not able to implement a lot of these because basically we lack the instruments, we lack the tools. But the most important thing is that the basics are the same. And I was lucky because Dr. Brad Petrisser, the surgeon I worked with at McMaster, he had an extensive experience of working in Africa in resource-limited setting. So he was not someone who would use the fluoroscopy every now and then, like many other surgeons that I encountered back there. But I do believe that it is very important to start our own training in Africa. We should be able to train people based on the needs of our context. For example, I'm not able to get a patient that needs surgery into the operating theater straight away. But in Canada, it was easy. Why? Because of the cost. In South Sudan, for example, when a patient does not afford surgery, then they delay getting access to the theater. And I end up dealing with fractures which are already old, malunited, and that needs a lot of, you know, more effort to try to make it work. But in Canada, it's a little bit easier because the fractures are fresh and then you can be able to manage them straight away. So, and another thing, like, for example, some of the implants that we use here, like a sign nail, good enough for me that I had experience with sign nail during my training and before I left to Canada. But for example, in Canada, for someone who had zero experience in Africa, they cannot be able to see the sign nail and how it is done. It's something that's used all over Africa. So that's the thing. The point is, at the end of the day, we need to be able to train people within the African context. That's the strategic way forward. That's what I think.
Just to follow up on that, Brian, like, how do you think we should start in your context, for example? Like, is it through like a college of surgeons like COSEXA? Is it a local training program? Is it training medical officers to do orthopedic procedures? Like, do you have a vision for that type of training program?
Yeah, I never mentioned that before because it's still new. We just formed an orthopedic society in South Sudan, and the number of orthopedic surgeons at the moment is 11. And I am the inaugural president, and we will launch the society in about 10 days from now. So it's something still new.
Well, we should just call you Mr. President. You should have told us before.
Yeah, but one of the objectives of the society is to be able to establish a local training program for orthopedic surgeons in South Sudan. We'll be happy to start with only one orthopedic surgeon and then see how it goes. COSEXA is a very, very important initiative. And actually, in our thought, we want our training to be integrated into the COSEXA model. So in the future, we think that our trainees are going to be able to do the COSEXA MCS and the fellowship to be able to fully qualify as a trained surgeon within South Sudan, as well as qualified to work all over Africa as a COSEXA fellow. And I think Juba Teaching Hospital, even though it doesn't have enough resources, but it's going to be certified in the near future. It's going to be certified as a COSEXA training program. So COSEXA training hospital. So at the moment, the biggest challenge that we have is that we lack instruments. Talking specifically about orthopedics, is that we lack instruments. And that's something that we're working on. And we have a lot of people who are helping us getting instruments and implants for us to be able to prepare for this important milestone. But yeah, I think COSEXA is the way forward for us.
Just one more question about this vision. Like, it's amazing, Brian. What do you think programs like, for example, the McMaster University or any Canadian training program or university, how can we help build such a program? Is there any assistance that Western countries, academic institutions can provide in building such training programs?
Of course, one thing that we can explore in the future is to have surgeons from the West come and spend some time with our trainees within South Sudan. Just the same thing that is done in Tanzania, where I did my training. So they come over and do some training sessions and so forth. But also, I think it's very important that, for example, if you have a five-year training program, we can arrange from the beginning a scholarship such as mine, the IOP, for example, IOP scholarship, for our trainee to spend some time in a Canadian hospital, in a Canadian university. It can either be in the middle of their training, or it can be a fellowship program that's going to be complementary to our training program within. So I think having that exposure in resourceful settings is very important. Like I really benefited a lot from my time in Canada. So I think it is important to integrate this as part of the training. So yeah, we can organize that our trainees go to Canada, as well as try to see if it's possible for doctors from Canada or from anywhere in North America or Europe come and spend some time in South Sudan and be able to train our surgeons here. Of course, if the security situation allows.
I'm sure we can make this happen, but I would request specifically to go to Torit.
No problem.
So Brian, first of all, I just want to say congratulations on establishing the Orthopedic Society. That's amazing. That's awesome. And like so great to hear. And so kind of in a related question to keeping surgeons in Africa, we heard you in an interview at McMaster be very vocal about the brain drain that unfortunately does occur in sub-Saharan Africa, externally to Europe and North America, but also internally from rural to urban environments. Can you kind of expand on your own personal reasons for going back to your home country of South Sudan and any potential solutions that you might know of or might think of to increase both in-country and in-region retention of healthcare professionals?
Yeah, so brain drain is a very big issue for us. Personally, I decided to go back, actually to come back to South Sudan, because the answer is simple. I just love this country, despite all the adversities. But I just love this country. So that's my main reason. I don't know if others would feel the same about South Sudan, but that's the main thing. For myself, I would say that I'm a little bit lucky, because as an orthopedic surgeon, at least I can get some income from the surgeries that I do and so forth. But I know a lot of doctors who actually are struggling to afford a living. And the main reason is that the government is not investing a lot in healthcare. The budget for healthcare is around 1%. The last budget we had was 2019-2020. So it was only 1% of the national budget. And we all know that the Abuja Declaration talks of about 15% of national budget going towards healthcare. So because of that, healthcare professionals in South Sudan are the least paid in the whole world, let me say. As I stand, I work with the government as a part-timer, because my main employer is the university. The government pays me around $10 per month. That's the salary. I know it looks, wow. It sounds crazy, but because there was a salary scale before the war broke out, it was in South Sudanese pounds, and then there was a lot of inflation, and the salaries were not adjusted. So I'm speaking for myself, $10. A lot of general practitioners get $7. A lot of nurses get $5. So you can imagine that's the main reason that drive people to start looking for greener pastures. And we're talking about Juba at the moment. I mentioned about brain drain from rural to urban areas, because you can imagine that if you cannot get proper healthcare facilities, you cannot get proper infrastructure in urban centers. In rural centers, it's almost completely zero. There's nothing. There's nothing to work with. I know a lot of surgeons who were qualified or trained in Ethiopia, and then when they came back to South Sudan, they asked them to go and work outside Juba. But when they reached there, they found that the facilities that they're working in do not have operating theaters, you know? So they cannot do anything. So these people who are trained outside, they start looking for, you know, better opportunities either within the region, mainly within the region, because there are countries like Kenya that pay doctors better. So we have a sizable number of very, very good South Sudanese doctors who are based in Kenya at the moment. So I think for us to be able to solve this problem, they need to be advocacy for the government to really work on increasing the budget for healthcare, because this is really a very, 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 very big challenge that if we don't solve it, we're not going to solve the problem of brain drain.
That's incredible. And I think a lot of us here in Canada and in North America in general have a hard time really kind of picturing what that really means, you know, what living on $10 a month means or the uphill battle that you have to face. So that really is incredible. And all the work you're doing to kind of improve the healthcare system there is awesome. So you recently tweeted, and I'll just read here so I quote it properly. KFC made a fortune out of a closely guarded recipe. On the contrary, in medicine, knowledge which is not shared is a form of witchcraft. P.S. I don't believe in witchcraft. Hashtag flustercuck. Hashtag SSOT. So kind of my question for you is growing mistrust in the medical system becoming a concern in South Sudan, or is this a more kind of globally addressed statement? I know that in one of your videos with McMaster, you mentioned that one of the main differences between healthcare in Canada and South Sudan is that there's considerably more trust from patients in South Sudan than in Canada. So just, I was hoping you could address that.
Yeah. There is, in South Sudan, actually, there is still a lot of trust in doctors. And I didn't know that you were going to quote my tweet, but it's okay.
it's public, Brian.
Yeah. So South Sudan still remains a country where there is a lot of respect for doctors. Basically, a lot of doctors offer their services without charge most of the time, and people trust doctors because there is a lot of humanity involved in the profession, and there is a lot of respect for doctors, despite the fact that many of us are not well paid, but we still continue to work in the country. I'm not speaking about myself, but I'm speaking about my other colleagues who are not, they are not getting money, but they continue to work. So the problem of mistrust towards doctors is not. It's not a huge issue at the moment. But of course, I know that you've heard recently about some killings which took place where two of our colleagues were unfortunately died in the line of duty. So that's an alarming thing that's coming up. Ideally, I would not love to talk a lot about that, but it's alarming for us to start seeing changes happening. But yeah, what I meant from that tweet is that in medicine, the essence of medicine is that we need to share the knowledge that we acquire. We need to share the skills that we acquire. And that is in line with the idea of trying to make sure that we train the doctors that come up to be able to provide proper care. Because we know that in 20, 30 years from now, we're not going to be there, but we need to make sure that we pass whatever we gain in terms of knowledge to the next generation who are unlucky, who are not lucky to get a chance to go and train outside or to get proper training. So that's in essence what I meant. But medicine still remains a noble profession in South Sudan.
Sorry, I actually hadn't heard the news about your colleague, so I'm very sorry to hear that. Yeah, sorry, that must be, that's terrible news. Also, and just to address the tweet again, in many of your tweets, you use the hashtag SSOT. For those who aren't familiar with the term, what does SSOT mean to you, and why do you believe it is so important?
The SSOT, the hashtag that we use, is actually a movement. It's actually South Sudanese on Twitter. Yeah, so South Sudan, if you go back maybe 3 or 4 years ago, we had little presence on Twitter, on social media, and we thought that it was important. That's why most of the tweets that actually come from South Sudan, we just put on the hashtag SSOT, which is South Sudan on Twitter.
Well, that's good, because I think we all need to learn more about that country and to be more aware of what's going on. But that's one of the ways that we can potentially support initiatives such as yours, which are so noble. And I'm glad to hear that you think, you know, partnering with institutions like ours could be beneficial to training surgeons and orthopedic surgeons in South Sudan. So, and I hope that can be the case in the future. We want to close it off. I don't want to keep you too long, but if you had to choose one actionable item, like something very specific with a clear time-bound target, something that could advance surgical care in your country, what would it be? One thing.
Well, that's a tough question, but still, I'm a strong advocate of training. So if there is something, if there is a legacy that we can, me and my group, that the group that is part of the Orthopedic and Trauma Society, if there is one legacy that we want to leave, is to establish a training program within South Sudan. And it can easily have a timeline that we can put in. It's going to be very difficult to implement, but that's actually one specific thing that we can really work on. And of course, I'm a huge believer of advancing research. So our training program it may need to run in tandem with medical research. The body of research in South Sudan, especially in orthopedics, is actually almost non-existent. And this is something that we need to work on. So if I would ask for something if I would work for something in South Sudan, that would be to establish a resident training program that focuses on research so that we can implement both at the same time.
That's good to hear, Brian. I think we can potentially work on that.
And last but not least, who would you recommend we host next on this podcast?
Of course, my very good friend, Dr. Mopor. Dr. Mopor is also an orthopedic surgeon. The name Mapour. We trained at around the same time in Tanzania. He was in another hospital, and we finished at around the same time in 2017. He's a great orthopedic surgeon, a good friend of mine, and he works a lot with the SINE nail program. He also had a chance to go to Ethiopia to do a fellowship in trauma, which focused on pelvis and acetabulum. So I would think that we share a lot of things together. We're all driven. We all share the idea of working on improving the healthcare system in South Sudan, and specifically orthopedic care in South Sudan. So there will be a recommendation to host Dr. Mopor, who is also the Secretary General of the South Sudan Orthopedics and Trauma Society.
Paul, did you take notes?
I did. Got it all down. Got the spelling and everything. So thank you. The spelling.
Brian, it was absolutely phenomenal to have you on this podcast. We learned so much about you, and I really hope we can work together in the future. I'll connect with you separately about the MSF training program in Awil in northern South Sudan, because we need some orthopedic support there. If you have some time, that would be really awesome to partner with you.
Thanks a lot, Emily. That would be great.
Thank you so much for joining us, Brian. I really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, Paul. It's a pleasure.
You have a great day. Save many lives.
You too. Thank you. Bye.
Bye. Thank you for listening to Off the Table, a global surgery podcast. Make sure to follow us on your favorite podcasting app and leave us a review. You can also find show notes and more information about past and future episodes on our website, www.patreon.com/offthetablepodcast. If you have comments or suggestions, you can email us at offthetablepod21@gmail.com or connect with us on Instagram, OTT_globalsurgery, and Twitter, offthetable_pod. We hope that you join us on our next episode.